welcome everyone in Paris and everyone wherever you are, who's ever tuning in. Please feel free to ask questions if you're not here. There will be a moment for questions for people here too. but it helps us throughout if people ask questions. There seems to be some technical difficulties going on.
We are upside down.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting position to be in.
And we have two viewers.
Okay. So, am I still upside down?
No. You're good.
I guess it's all a question of perspective. Right. If you're standing on your head watching, then I am upside down. So this is the last night of our retreat that we've been doing all week in the heart of life. Whether you were one of the 70 people who was registered for this retreat or not, you were part of this retreat. And this retreat is not actually ending tonight, although we say it is, because our life and our practice never ends. It's continuous. So, with that, I'd like to look at what the last course of our meal that we were preparing this week, guided by Bernie Glassman's book, Instructions to the Cook. If you've been following this on the blog, you've gone through it step by step. If you're familiar with this book, it's much better to read Bernie's version than to read what I put on the blog. Although, of course, there's different things that I say on the blog that Bernie does not say in his book, and he says things in his book that I didn't say on the blog. So, and you will discover things in your life that neither one of us said. And that's what's really important, is that you discover it for yourself, not just read what we write. Both Bernie and I, what we write, Bernie won't be writing anything more because Bernie died 10 days ago. but whatever he wrote, whatever I wrote and write, comes directly from our experience of what we're talking about. So it's not like we're just reading a book and repeating it. I am using Bernie's book as the structure. However, I know what he's talking about from my own experience. So that's what I'm trying to share with you. So today's, what I gave you today was the fifth course of the meal, which is relationship and community. And this meal includes all of the other courses. This course includes all of the other courses. So the first course, I just remind you, was spirituality. Second course was study and learning. Third course is livelihood. In French, it's moyen d'existence. I won't give the French translations of all of these, but sometimes it's helpful. And unfortunately, I don't know them in Portuguese. It would be fantastic if somebody translated Bernie's book in Portuguese. Maybe it exists in Brazilian Portuguese. I wouldn't be surprised, because there was a teacher who worked with Bernie who has a center there in Portugal. In Brazil. So I'm sorry, I don't know what they are in Portuguese. So livelihood, social action is the fourth course, and then fifth course today is relationship and community. And a story that I like that illustrates this one very well, which I may have used before in a talk, I'm not sure. I know that I used it in an article that I wrote for a Buddhist magazine here, so I can't remember if I talked about it too, but it's a story that apparently, Bernie says, appears on a scroll, a Zen scroll. I've heard it, I've done some research on it when I wrote about it in this magazine, and it exists in various different traditions, not only Zen. Even in Christian traditions, I've found this story told in slightly different versions. In any case, there in the Zen version, there is a scene on the scroll, there's a scene of hell. And hell is this table set with a fabulous banquet, with amazing food, the most delicious delicacies you can imagine, huge quantities, everything that anyone could desire for a meal, a feast. And around this table are seated a number of people, and they have extremely long spoons. And they are suffering desperately because no matter how hard they try, their spoons are too long for them to dip into the food and put into their mouths. So it's just physically impossible. The spoons are too long. And so they're dying of hunger there and suffering and angry with each other and whatever. That's hell. And then the heaven image, it's the same feast, same food, everything, same scene, same people sitting around the table, same long spoons. But in this version, each person is extending his spoon to feed the person across the table. So everyone is being fed and everyone is feeding. And everyone's happy. So this is the happy end, happily ever after. Now this is where all of these courses come together. Bernie's using these courses as an illustration of cooking the supreme meal of your life. A whole fulfilled life has these five courses. And he uses the Zen cook in a Zen monastery or a Zen retreat as someone who also incorporates these five courses into the meal that he prepares to be served in Orioki as we eat it in our formal eating practice. So this illustration of these hungry ghosts with the long spoons illustrates what happens when we don't see our interconnection and we see ourselves as isolated beings, and what happens when we do see it. That if we see this interconnection and we see the other truly, and we don't focus only on ourselves, then we can freely give and freely receive. Now today on the blog, I talked about Orioki and this chant that we have of 72 labors brought us this food. 72 travaux. How does it grow in French? We should know how it comes to us. And this chant that we recite calls us to recognize this interconnection, and it's endless, actually, if we try to find all of the labors that brought us this food. We say 72 because it's a big number. However, it's far more than that. This is a call to us to remember that, and therefore to have that mindset, to have that in mind when we're receiving it. And among the 72 labors are the people who are serving it to us, and the cook who made it, and the people who helped the cook during the work period, and the people who did the shopping to bring the food to the work period, and on and on and on and on. So we don't just eat the food. We do eat the food. We receive it, however. and we recognize how it came to us. This changes then the way that we receive the food, if we recognize how it came to us. And the Zen cook who's preparing it, also, it changes if he's preparing it with this, what he's cultivated through his spiritual meditative practice, his or her, I should say, in our meditation, our spiritual practice, all the practices are aimed at cultivating an experience of oneness, of non-separation, non-duality. And when the cook is preparing the food, that is the space that he or she is in. That's why we say this Zen cook in a monastery traditionally is someone who's very advanced in the practice and recognizes this, recognizes the one that you and I are one, and prepares the food with that in mind to nourish all of the hungry spirits throughout space and time. We know for ourselves, if we're at home cooking just for ourselves alone, or making a meal alone just for ourselves, it's not the same thing as if we're cooking and preparing a meal for other people. And some people, I know I can include myself in this, sometimes I'm not very motivated to just cook for myself. So I'll just eat, you know, have a piece of cheese and an apple or something, instead of preparing a full meal. I know my mother, for example, who lives alone, is elderly. She's not really motivated to make... She's not so hungry, you know. Her appetite as she gets older is kind of reduced, and she knows she has to eat, but she's not really motivated to just cook for herself all the time, alone, and eat alone. Well, this is a really telling fact that I think most of us can relate to. It makes a difference when we include other people, when we are offering this food. And it also makes a difference, so it's not just randomly offering it. So we've invited people to come and share it. So we invite people to come, and we've invited them because we want to, whatever. Or it's our family, and we want to nourish them. It's our friends. It could be a soup kitchen, you know, serving people who live in the streets and don't have food. It could be working in a restaurant. I mean, I'm just sticking with the food precisely motif, but this can apply to everything in our life, in fact. The other night, we invited people for dinner, and I actually felt like making a curry. I was hungry for curry. And I wanted to make a dal and some really nice shrimp or fish curry, vegetables and rice. But these people were a family from Ecuador, who, part of them, a young couple and their young child, had just moved here to live here for 3 years while they were studying, graduate studies. And their mother, the mother of the husband and the couple, was here visiting for a few months. She was a real Francophile. And she had lived in France when she was a student many, many years ago. So I thought, you know, I'm not going to make her Indian food. No, she's in France. Let's do a French dinner. So I didn't make what I wanted to make, but actually I did want to make the French food for them and take some time deciding what to make and pick some nice wines and some nice cheese and make it a nice French meal. Of course, I'm an American cooking a French meal, but I've lived here so long that I'm probably as much French and I cook French food. So. And so according to the circumstances, we will also prepare different food, according to the ingredients we have. Had I been in Ecuador, I don't think I would have made a French meal, because you can't find good French cheese, good French wine, it's not the same ingredients, It's not the same context. So we use what we have, what's appropriate to the situation, as Bernie also teaches us. And the way that we can see what's appropriate is by practicing the other courses. So with our meditation practice, that helps us to deepen, just be here with what is, and see the oneness of things, therefore not judging, not saying this is good and this is bad. It's more what is appropriate and what's not appropriate. With the study and learning, that sharpens our intelligence, that helps us to fine-tune our awareness as well. It also, we learn skills that we can apply. So I've learned to cook French food. I've learned about French wine. I could make this meal. Because I have deepened my spiritual practice, I can know when it's appropriate to use whichever skill I've learned. One of the stories, it's not in this book that Bernie tells it, but he gives the example of if you only learn how to use a hammer and you think that a hammer solves all problems, and someone calls you to help do something in their house and they need a screwdriver, you won't be able to do it because you will have this fixed idea about what's necessary, and you will have restricted your study and learning to the hammer. And the screwdriver then isn't there. You didn't bring it. You don't know how to use it. Now, how does that apply to our livelihood, as we said? Is the third course. I went through this on the blog about, I think I did, anyway, about in the Buddhist tradition, right livelihood, as we call it, is considered livelihood that does no harm, that doesn't create suffering, basically. So what does that mean? What does it mean not creating harm? What does that mean not creating suffering? Sometimes we can, in our modern world, we've adapted that, because it's a different context, maybe too, to try to limit the harm that we create, or the suffering that is created, as much as possible. So instead of, manufacturing rifles, we might choose to manufacture, cooking utensils or something. Of course, we will be polluting the environment to some extent with the making of cooking utensils. And maybe we will be, by creating a factory and building cooking utensils and paying people wages, we will be eliminating... we will be harming someone else's business that was creating cooking utensils. I don't know, we can't possibly know all the consequences of our acts. But the more that we are aware and paying attention and seeing the oneness rather than the separation, the more that we will be attentive to and not want to do harm in our livelihood. Instead of pursuing businesses that make profit just for the sake of profit, we might seek a business that makes profit that can be poured back into some sort of social action, that's Bernie's model, actually. Because throughout his book, he talks about his work that he started in New York in the 80s, in which his community needed to find some way to support themselves. They had this big Zen center, and 30 people were living there, but they needed to support themselves. Some people had regular jobs, others didn't, and they needed to pay the bills and pay the mortgage and keep the center running. So instead of doing what we did and rent out the space, they decided to start a business that would sustain them. And so they sat down, and Bernie goes through all of this. They, part of their study and learning process was to sit down and reflect on and study what would be appropriate for our community. What could we do? What skills do we have? What could we learn? What businesses would be profitable for us but do not so much harm? What would be a good business? And they looked around and they checked out different things. And they were inspired by the San Francisco Zen Center, which had chosen to bake bread and created a bakery and a fabulous vegetarian restaurant that was vastly famous in San Francisco. I don't know if it still exists. Greens, it's called. And back in the day, you had to wait 2 months. You had to make reservations 2 months in advance and everything. And so they were inspired by that. So they went out and looked at how they were doing it and studied that for like a month. No, first they just went to check it out and talk to them. And then they decided that they would try to do a bakery, because that seemed to work for the San Francisco Zen Center, the bakery. And they went out there and studied how San Francisco did it. A few of the people went, and Bernie went, and stayed there for a month and learned from the experience and watched how they functioned and everything and how they set it up, made a business plan, what kind of equipment they would need and all of this stuff, and managed to get loans. Actually, I think they didn't get loans from banks because banks wouldn't give them any loans. It would be like if we went and tried to get a loan. But they had wealthy people in their community, or they had people in their community who knew wealthy people who lent them the money. Bought all the equipment and everything, and started doing it, but it didn't work. The bread, the recipes from San Francisco didn't work in New York, because the flour wasn't the same. And the water was different. And the temperatures were different. And the equipment they had was different. It just didn't work the same. So they checked, they looked, and they started making cakes instead, which seemed like a better thing. And that seemed to work. And they looked around so they had a marketing effort where they went around to different clients and tried to sell their cakes. And one of the clients that they got was Neiman Marcus, this, big department store. And soon after that, Godiva Chocolates, who wanted them to make some special cake that they had, that Godiva had. And they were looking for someone who could do it. And they got the contract, and so they started doing this. And it created a huge scandal within their community, but also outside in the greater Zen world, that they were making cakes and fancy pastries to sell to rich people. And some people said, this is not Zen. Zen is not about making cakes and selling it to rich people. Or not even, it's not about making cakes and working. It's about sitting on your cushion. So some of them left. Other people said, it's not about selling to rich people. We should be, how can we do this? How is this ethically acceptable for us to be selling rich cakes to rich people? We're being elitist. And they already were in a very kind of elite suburb of New York, and in this big mansion, which led to them changing then their whole model, their business model. Not that they said it wasn't Zen, and not that they didn't want to sell to rich people, but they decided that they would still sell to rich people, but they would go into the community, the next suburb over, or the next neighborhood over, which was really poor, run down, full of drug addicts, crime, homeless people. And they would set up their bakery there. They would hire the people who lived there. They would train them. They would give them jobs, and then eventually, from there, because these people needed to be trained and they didn't have anywhere to live, because most of them were living on the streets or in motels that apparently welfare would pay for at that great expense, and then they would have to move out a month later or something. So they decided to they bought an apartment building, renovated it, hired local people to renovate it, put people into the apartments, gave the apartments to people, they got rent, they got some subsidies to pay for the rent, gave these people jobs, because a lot of them were single parents, mostly women, they needed childcare, so they created a child care center for the people who worked there. And there was a problem with AIDS at the time in the community. So they eventually created an AIDS help center and hospice. All the while, making cakes and extravagant gourmet pastries for Bloomingdale's, Neiman Marcus, Godiva chocolates. And their cakes were fabulous success. Everyone loved them. And they got, you know, great reviews, gourmet magazine, whatever. And in the beginning, people had said to them, well, you know, you should keep it secret that you're a Zen group, because people won't like that. Then they won't buy the cakes anymore. They think that they're being made by a Zen group. But Bernie didn't think so. It wasn't that was going to be his greatest selling point, but he wasn't going to hide it. And it became known, and that even made the cakes more popular. People thought it was even more impressive, and they liked them even more. So that was as if that was a special ingredient that they had that made the cakes more popular. Eventually, they associated through networking, because the network aspect is what today is about, the interconnection. And by networking, it means you extend beyond just the people who share your interests. You extend beyond just who you think is your family. You extend, it's kind of like what we do here. We rent the space, but we don't limit to just the people who do Zen practice like we do. We're constantly looking to extend it, to open our arms to whoever would like to use this space. Of course, we have some constraints. We have the constraints. It's a building that has people living here, so it can't be too loud. The owner asked us to have people associated with us who do more or less the kind of work that we do, the kind of practice we do, meaning personal development, spiritual activity, self-help, you know, what we say in French, médecine douce, so it could be shiatsu, yoga, tai chi, things like this. Those are our constraints, but within those constraints, we try to open as much as possible. And that's what Bernie did too, with Greystone and the bakery. And through networking, he connected with other entrepreneurs. He prefers entrepreneur instead of businessman, who were interested in social enterprises, social action enterprises. They were interested in making money and using that money for social activities, and using their enterprise for social activities. And at a conference in which he was present talking about his project, he met these two guys who had an ice cream company, Ben and Jerry. And they connected, and they were trying to figure out how they could work together. And initially, Ben and Jerry had thought that they could sell one of these cookies that they were developing, Greystone, in Ben and Jerry's stores. But the problem was that the cookies they were making had to be refrigerated. And Ben and Jerry's didn't have any facilities in their stores to refrigerate these cookies. So it would have meant Ben and Jerry would have had to change entirely all of their stores and all of their way of functioning just to host these cookies. So they decided that wasn't going to work. So they put it aside. And then eventually what happened was Ben and Jerry's had some sort of ice cream cake that they made, and they had a special chocolate. The cake part was a special chocolate things. I don't know, I've never had it myself. And they weren't so happy with the whoever was making it. I can't remember why. And so this Ben and Jerry's asked Bernie if Greystone could do it. But the problem was that their quality control people said it had to be exactly the same recipe. It had to taste exactly the same as the other producers. So I think the other producer was going to keep making part of it, some of it. But the other producer would not share its recipe. So Bernie's people spent months and months and months testing, trying to find a recipe that, trying to find something that looked like these fudge cakes. And they thought they came up with it, and Ben and Jerry thought it was great. But the quality control people came back. After they had invested, Bernie and Greystone had invested in all kinds of new equipment so they could do this, the quality control people came back and said, no, it doesn't work. It's not good enough. So meanwhile, Ben and Jerry said, well, you know, why don't you make for us, in the meantime, these, we have this, I forget what it's called, you know, chocolate fudge brownie ice cream, whatever it is. Do you know what it's called?
Cookie dough.
It's not cookie dough. It's something with brownies in it. Does anyone know? Anyway. Mm. And we need somebody to make the brownies for it. So they started making the brownies. So Greystone started making the brownies for it. And still to this day, I think, they make Greystone's brownies are in that Ben and Jerry's ice cream. So this was a way of reaching out beyond just our little blinded path or community and seeing the wider connections, seeing that it's vast, that people aren't competitors, but they are also people trying to do the same thing we're doing and working together. So feeding each other. It was great for Ben and Jerry's that they had these brownies. And it was great for Greystone that they could supply, that they could make these brownies and work with Ben and Jerry's. And which meant that that was new business that could help the building, the housing projects, the training of the locals, everything, the whole Mandela of Bernie's work. Anyway, that's what his book is about, Instructions to the Cook. But he uses this theme of the five courses. And it's a fabulous example of how this can apply to our lives. Of course, not all of us are starting bakeries. Not all of us are trying to feed the homeless. Not all of us are trying to finance renovation of a building so that we can house the homeless. But we do have in our lives the same thing happening, and we can apply the same thing. I was thinking today about our project here in the center, which is not really the same in the sense that we're not looking towards feeding the homeless or housing refugees or even using this space for some activity with homeless people or refugees. At the same time, in our way, we have studied and learned skills that we needed and we are still studying and learning, and we still need to learn and study more to broadcast a talk like this, to have a space, to know how to run a space like this, to know how to run the accounts, to have the contracts, to receive people, to have a protocol for people when they come here, have it furnished with various things. We're doing our learning as we're practicing. Like Bernie says, he likes to have his learning going on simultaneous with the practice. And that's what we have done here. That's how I was trained. That's what works for us in this situation. As I said, it's not our livelihood individually, as it were. None of us is making any money from this, is receiving any money from this. However, we do pay the rent with it. It does pay our rent. The activity we do by welcoming other people here and hosting their groups pays the rent for us, which means it sustains, on some level, the needs of our group. We needed a space. And we didn't have any money to pay for it, so we found this solution. And actually, the owner of the place found a great solution when he found us, because otherwise he had to manage the place and find people to rent it. And it wasn't working for him. It was too much trouble. And he found somebody who would take over that responsibility for him and run it for him. So we're doing a service for him too. And we're doing a service for the people we rent it to. And we're doing a service for ourselves because we have space to practice. And we like the idea that other people, we really like it that other people benefit from it. I think all of us are very happy when people come and say, oh, this was great, we really liked it. Thank you. We're happy that they found a place because we know what it's like. We see them as us in that sense. We've been there. We've looked for spaces. We've looked and tried to find and not been able to use spaces. So in a sense, we have this model here. We could do far more with it. Definitely. But we're learning. We're learning. It's never perfect. And yet it is perfect, as it is. It's been a great practice for us, and it still is. And it's never finished. So I was just looking at my notes here, and I saw that I made this note here that this quote from Bernie that is, what matters is that we keep on living our lives to the fullest, savoring the meals we cook, offering our food to all the hungry spirits we invite into our kitchens. So that's the point. It's just to keep living our lives fully and savoring it all. Savoring what we consider good, savoring what we consider bad, and keep offering the meals that we prepare. And he relates this to the Bodhisattva vow, which we chant. Sentient beings are numberless, etc. And the Bodhisattva vow is endless in the sense that the Bodhisattva vows to not, technically, just if we stick with the doctrine of Buddhism, the Bodhisattva vows to not enter nirvana and fully enjoy his enlightenment or her enlightenment until all other beings have gone there. And this is a very long time then that the Bodhisattva will accept to not go, we say, to the other shore. Because there are still people on this shore. There are still beings on this shore that are suffering, that are in difficulty, that need help, that are hungry. And so the Bodhisattva makes this vow to stay until all of those people have been fed. Now, the trick is that the Bodhisattva makes his vow. However, by staying, and helping and feeding, that is nirvana. So the bodhisattva is already there. That is enlightenment, is to see that and do that and live that fully. That is nirvana. So we say the bodhisattva is waiting to go through, going to the other side, but the bodhisattva knows that he's already there. But the people who are there don't know that. And that's why the bodhisattva stays there. It's like my teacher said to me, you have to meet people where they are. I read this, I was reading recently, there's a special edition of Philosophy Magazine, which I only ever buy when I travel, that magazine. And I bought it when I went to Portugal recently. And especially because it was a special edition about Michel Serre, who's a really interesting French philosopher. And who's not like huge intellectual stuff, the way that he presents things. Anyone know Michel Serre? Yeah. I was just reading at the beginning of this interview that he was doing with some like high school students, because he wrote this book, Petite Poussette, I forget it. I think it's feminine, actually, Petite Poussette, which is talking about the generation who was basically born with cell phones in their hand. So young people. And who use their thumbs. And they were saying to him, yeah, you know, you're different. You're so far away from, your generation is so far from ours. So I think Michel Serre is like almost 90 years old. And he said, yes, it's true. In age, we're very different. And also, but in terms of the technology, because my generation, you were born with cell phones in your hands. My generation, we knew something else before that. And he said something about education that was, he said the problem with education is that, I guess he was talking about France, but I'm not sure, is that people keep trying to say the program has to be adjusted. You have to change what matière, you know, what subjects you're offering. You know, you have to change how the subjects are talked about or whatever. And he said, but that's not, they're missing the point. That you have, what's needed is to look at who the students are. And then you develop a program according to who the students are. Which I thought that is, you know, that's really brilliant. Brilliant in the sense that I can relate to it from a Zen point of view. You meet people where they are. And you, like, I didn't offer an Indian meal to this Ecuadorian family. Because we were in France and they wanted to have the French experience, I offered them French food. So, it doesn't mean that you, I think I was saying this in Portugal recently, you keep your eye on the ball, at the same time adapting to the situation and the circumstances. It doesn't mean you water things down. It doesn't mean that you will not offer the first course. But it means that you will adapt how that course is offered and how it is presented and what it contains, maybe, according to the circumstances and the audience and the people. We know that in our lives in general, you know, we teach 5-year-olds to sing in a different way than we would teach adults to sing. Or, you know, maybe there are some common things. If I'm teaching meditation, I would teach it differently to a group of people who have never, ever had any meditation experience, or people who are at a Zen retreat, than I would if I went into a business and I was teaching meditation to some business people. I would teach it differently. It's a different audience. The offering can be the same. I'm still offering meditation teaching, but I won't do it in the same way. And the more we deepen our first course, our spiritual process, the more that we then become aware of that, of the oneness, the more that it becomes clear self and other is an illusion. And that helps us then to open our horizons and see the interdependency, which was the whole point of today's course. So I think we probably have a few minutes, not many.
Yeah, 7 minutes.
Okay, any questions or comments that anyone would like to contribute? Bernie Glassman does this the opposite way around. He asks for the questions, and then according to the questions, he gives his talk. So if there are no questions, he doesn't give a talk. However, I've never seen that happen.
I have a question. Sometimes I get overwhelmed by what I see in the interactivity of things, like my... I don't really know how to put it into words. It's when I see that everything is so interreacted, I see it seems like I sense that I need to do so much more, and it becomes too much. How is that?
In what
related?
Way do you mean you need to do so much more?
It just seems like I need to know more. I need to practice more. I need to. It seems like everything is so interconnected. That like everything, every person that I come in contact with is going to be affected by me, and maybe I'm reacting too much, but it's just listening to this interacted, this meal, this course of this, everything is so interconnected, and I'm wondering.
Well, and I think that that's where this notion of what we call the right amount, where that comes in. We always talk about the right amount. What is the right amount of food to eat, to offer, to cook? And the more that we become, that we sit with just being here now with whatever is, the more we study and learn, the more that that becomes clear, we pay more attention to, okay, in this situation, this is the right amount. You know, I don't need to, I don't need to do anything more for that person. In this situation, that's fine. You know, I said hello and that's fine, whatever. An interesting thing happened yesterday on the blog. Someone was trying to post something. And she wrote to me, she said, I've tried 3 times to post, and it won't allow me to post something on the blog. And she said, I've tagged it on here for you, so you can read it or something. And what do you think? Is there something wrong with the blog? What she wrote was like pages and pages of what her day had been and all her observations about it and looking into her whole career with work because it was about livelihood and all of this stuff and pages and pages and pages. And so I wrote back to her and I said, I don't know if there's a limit of characters or something on the for the comments, but probably that's what's happening. And I said, but there's nothing wrong then with this situation, however. This is a great practice for you to look at what is the right amount. In this context, writing something, posting it on the blog in this context, for this audience, for this week that we're doing, what is the right amount? What's appropriate amount? And I said, this can help you to see, well, what is the essential thing? What do I really want to say? What is the point of what I'm trying to say? It doesn't mean that the rest of what she's saying is not valid. It just means that in this situation, this is what's appropriate. And I encouraged her to look at that. And she did. Then today or yesterday or some, she posted something to that effect on the blog, I think, if I remember correctly. So it's, you know, staying attentive, not so much, am I doing the right thing? Am I not? Is this not the right thing? But what do I feel is appropriate in this situation? And acknowledging that I can't do everything. And because that's kind of like overeating. Or I'm not doing anything at all, which is like not eating at all. So what's the right amount? You can only know by experience and practice. I think we're probably out of time.
No? Right amount.
What?
Right amount.
Okay. So thank you, everyone. Good night.